Good morning, everyone. Yesterday, I was talking to a very dear friend of mine. And he has this condition called OCD. Some of you may be aware of it. Obsessive compulsive disorder. So he is used to a very structured day. You know, a routine of sorts, going to a certain restaurant at a certain time, going to work at a certain time, so on and so forth. And so he was telling me that with this lockdown, it is as if God has forced him to look at himself. Because he has not been able to step out. But not only that, he said, it is so interesting because he had moved into a new apartment just before the lockdown. So he was made comfortable. He had brought his work home before the lockdown, so he has work to do. But the core issue, who am I with all my fears? He was left to address only that in these two and a half months. Everything else was provided. Even his food was provided. He's a single man, and his cook, her son delivers the food to him on his scooter and he picks it up from below the building. Even food was provided. Beautiful home was provided. Beautiful home with a view was provided. So that now he could look at himself and his issues and fears. You see, in that sense, this lockdown is a gift. It is, I can't even say it is giving us an opportunity. It is forcing us to look within ourselves, look at our fears, and perhaps recalibrate our lives, re-evaluate our lives, what is important and what is not important anymore. Now, another friend of mine asked me that, Gautam, does this mean that everyone will look within since we all are forced into the lockdown? And the answer is no. Everyone comes in with their destiny. Some people may be too stuck in their stories, in their dramas, and those same dramas get perpetuated. Only now the confinement can in fact accentuate the drama of the mind, because the mind doesn't like being locked down. The mind likes being in control, and now all controls have been taken away. So, while it is an opportunity for more people to look within, whether that opportunity is taken or not is not really in a person's hands. But having said that, most likely many more people who were not questioning life, not questioning their interactions, their routines, and started doing that. I have noticed that myself because I'm getting more and more emails, more and more comments. So an opening has been created. An opening which was forced upon us, because if it was not forced upon us, then most likely this acceleration of the inner journey would not have happened. So do consider it a gift despite the severe limitations we are going through, do consider it a gift which perhaps will make our lives simpler, whatever is left of the rest of our lives will be made simpler, anchored in peace, equanimity, and calm. I would like to share with you all an incident, a divine coincidence, you could call it. And in fact, there is an audio podcast which I recorded on this topic, which will come up in due course. You see, what I have currently been doing for some of these audio podcasts is reading out quotations of a master whose name was Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj. He was the guru of Nisargadatta Maharaj. And as some of you might know, Nisargadatta Maharaj was my spiritual master, Ramesh Balsekar's guru. So you could say it is a kind of lineage in a sense of sorts. Of course, they all had many disciples who also started speaking and became gurus in their own right. Now, so I was selecting passages which I had underlined to read out in the podcast because they impacted me tremendously. And then I would add some insights. Now, one passage I came across was quite strong. You see, these masters were not gentle. Thankfully, Rameshji was gentle, but the others were more direct. So, Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj said that people who talk trash eat trash. People who talk trash eat trash. And then he went on to explain that someone who grumbles, complains, condemns, criticizes, judges, and so on and so forth, that person will never get good food to eat. Now, this sounded quite abstract to me. The correlation between the individual sense of suffering, let's say, and blaming and judging and condemning and so on, and the food they ate. So that stayed at the back of my mind. This was in the morning when I had read this quotation. Now, in the evening, I went to the building terrace. Since we are up there because we could not go out onto Marine Drive like we can now. And I met a neighbor. And this neighbor, lovely man, he's a kind of a yogi. But at the same time, a lot of criticism and judgment about people. Because of course, in his eyes, he feels that way. So this is not about whether he's right or wrong. The point I'm making is, so he kept talking about some committee members in an organization near our home, and you know, this is not right, that is not right, this one, that one. And he went on and on and on. And I said, look, you know, we're going to have problems with all committees, and that's how it is. That's the nature of these structures. So what's the point of wasting one's life force in all this, you know? Anyway, he finished what he said, and then the topic came to, he asked me that, do you know any good fruit seller? So what we have been doing is we have all in the building been collating our orders for fruits so that the supply can come at one time and together. So I said, aren't you part of that collective so that you also get the fruits? He said, every time I get these fruits, they are bad. Either the grapes are bad, the papaya is bad, or this is bad, and that is bad. And I thought of Siddharameshwar Maharaj in the morning. I said, look at the compassion of the sage, you know. Even the doubt which I had in the morning of the correlation between food and criticism gets dissolved. Now, I don't know, this could be a one-off situation or what, but it's amazing how this teaching works, you see. It comes into your daily life in various ways. That is why the masters say constant reflection, contemplation, being absorbed with it all the time. Well, I think it's Vimalananda who said, what you think about all the time, you become. And then Siddharameshwar Maharaj said, if you think of Brahman all the time, you become Brahman. Simple. One starts viewing everything in the light of this teaching. That is what one will find. Now, someone asked a question on the difference between insight, intuition, and instinct, which any dictionary online, if you go, you will find the difference. So let's just very briefly look at this in light of peace, because what we are here together for is peace of mind. Not in adding knowledge to ourselves of words and their meanings. This is very important because the mind tends to do that. The mind wants to acquire knowledge, whereas true knowledge is the removal of ignorance. True knowledge is not the acquiring of more and more knowledge. So simply put, when there's an insight into a situation, that means that first you have thought about it, you have weighed the pros and cons and so on. And perhaps one day while you're sitting, sipping your coffee, a sudden insight comes. That, oh yes, this is the option to choose. That is an insight. But the matter is generally studied and one will find that, in fact, I have seen this very often in meditation, especially in group meditations. You know, after the meditation, someone will say, a problem at work, which had been really concerning me for so long, I got an insight into it during the meditation. So that is because the thinking mind in meditation calmed down and things were seen clearly. Things were seen with clarity. So in the meditation, that insight came. Insight came. Not I produced the insight, you see. Very important distinction. Now, instinct, of course, is the simplest. It is what you are hardwired to do instinctively. Like, I know a lady from the Marwari community who's very good with money, you see. She can make money out of anything. She gets into any form of work and she can turn a profit in it. She's good at cost cutting and profit making and this and that. And it's an instinct because the genetic blueprint, the conditioning is all already hardwired. So it comes naturally. This is an instinct. It's not something which she has to struggle with. So that is what is your instinct, you see. Now, intuition is where it becomes interesting with relation to peace. Because by and large, we are all intuitive human beings. Intuition is a feeling. Your mind tells you you have to go somewhere, but you feel you don't want to go. The mind, the brain, and the seat of intuition, which is the gut, it is called the gut brain, the intestines, the Manipur chakra, the solar plexus, and so on. Both are similar in structure. The structure of the brain and the structure of the intestines, if you see it, you know that. So intuition does not rely on the thinking mind. In fact, when the thinking mind gets stilled, an intuition can come. When the thinking mind is overactive, overanalyzing, judging, there is no room for intuition. So intuition is a feeling. And one will find that with this teaching, with the thinking mind getting quieter and quieter and quieter. Why? Because there is no longer any condemnation, blame, hatred, malice, guilt, shame, jealousy, envy, so on and so forth. That garbage has been thrown out. So with the thinking mind calming down, the intuitive faculties start opening up more and more. Not your doing. It starts happening. And responses to situations could change. What was earlier a hardwired knee-jerk reaction based on past conditioning, when one now sees events happen, things are going to play out the way they are going to play out. That baggage of me pointing fingers at people and accusing and blaming them, if that drama is removed, the mind is now more vacant to deal with what is. Not how I see it as an individual with this whole drama of my life story and my conditioning and the poor me who wants to protect itself all the time. In this light of clarity, when situations are seen, the response becomes intuitive, a felt response. So one may find that the heavy reliance on the thinking mind starts getting disengaged. And then even work becomes so beautiful, especially people who are involved in work, which is being in the moment. Like let's say a surgeon. Then the working mind with all its past experience is brought to the task at hand, to the operation at hand in front, with the wavering thinking mind out of the way. So being engaged with the working mind itself is a meditation, one could say. In the waking state, with the eyes open. So one will find that one is more and more in the working mind. When something has to be done, one is focused. One will find that one's responses are more and more intuitive responses, not this hardwired, survival-based, fear-based response, which is all the time coming from the past, and so on and so forth. Now I am going to ask you all a riddle, because I thought about it when this question on instinct, intuition, and insight came, and see if you get the answer. And after that, we will open up for questions if there are any. Please listen very carefully to this riddle. Here is an interesting riddle, the correct answer of which was provided by 80% of kindergarten school children. and by only 17% of university graduates. Now I'm going to add here before I ask the riddle that take only 10 seconds to get your answer, maybe 5, and then forget about it. So here goes. Please listen carefully. What is it that is greater than God and more evil than the devil, which the poor have and the rich do not need, and which will kill you if you eat it? I'm going to say this once more faster. What is that which is greater than God and more evil than the devil, which the poor have and the rich do not need, and which will kill you if you eat it? I want to see if anyone has their hands up. That means they've got the answer. I can see only one hand. And I don't know if the answer is going to be right or wrong. But the answer, my friends, is nothing. What is it that is greater than God and more evil than the devil, which the poor have and the rich do not need, and which will kill you if you eat it? You see, that is the simplicity of the child. The child would have answered this riddle by just hearing what is greater than God. But our human minds, which get so complex and complicated and conditioned to question, weigh the different options, the pros and cons and left and right, we get all muddled. And this simplicity of life is what we miss. This glorious, wonderful sense of presence and being. Who we are has got trampled over by who we think we are. This teaching gives you nothing. This teaching gives you no thing. A thing can be taken away. An object, a thing can be taken away. An object, a thing may make you dependent on that thing. And the gift of this teaching is no thing, which translates as the deepest peace you could imagine. No crutches. No support structures, which are transient and temporary. We are looking at eternal peace with no compromise. My teacher used to talk about Nisargadatta Maharaj when all the foreigners used to visit him. In fact, Maharaj himself would say, after you have been everywhere, done everything and tried everything, you have come to this teacher. Or rather, you have been dragged by the ear to my door in Khetwadi. That is what Maharaj used to say, in this low-income dwelling where he used to be in Bombay. And Rameshji would say that people started calling him the guru of the last resort. When all else doesn't work, when you accept God's will prevails at all times, And nobody truly does anything, even though it may appear so. Then this teaching welcomes you with open arms. So now let's open up the floor to questions. If anyone has, I'll take a look and we'll see where that goes. Yes, Vandana.
Hi, Gautam. I wanted to ask you this question that, you know, like you say, everything is God's will. And if one leads a life with a response which is filled with equanimity, what is the need to go to sadhus, gurus, astrologers? What does one gain or lose from that?
There is no need to go if one's life is full of peace and calm and equanimity.
Mm-hmm. Yet everyone wants to go to a guru and find a guru. That is their whole aim, purpose in life.
That is because they want the peace, whether they know it or not. That is why the search of the guru. In fact, that is the most sincere search, because you are no longer searching for a relationship of give and take, which is all our relationships, whether it is family, friends, or whatever. The sincere search is the search of the guru as the remover of darkness, the giver of light. It is the most intimate relationship. So it is a very earnest search when there is a search for the guru.
Is this a fatalistic attitude?
What is?
That everything is God's will.
That is for you to contemplate on. You see, Vandana, the ego, wants to feel it is in control and in charge of things. So it is the ego which says, oh, this is a fatalistic attitude. Everything is God's will. That is the ego talking with its sense of doership. Because you will find that there are many people living their daily lives with this understanding that everything is God's will, and yet they will do precisely that which they think and feel they should do. But now their burden is lighter, because they know that having done what they think and feel they should do, the results are not in their control. That is the difference the teaching makes. It does not lead to fatalism. It is the ego's last defenses that, you mean I am not in control? You mean I can't control outcomes? What is your life's experience? Are you able to control outcomes so far? So it is something the ego knows already, but it keeps rearing its head up. Me, 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 I'm the one. Look at me, I'm the one. How can you say this, that I'm not in control? Then I will be fatalistic, my attitude will be fatalistic. This is how the ego works, because it is so scared, because its survival is at threat.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Aki.
Hi, Gautam. You able to see me?
Yes.
Perfect. So Gautam, regarding Ramana Maharshi's teaching, which says, you know, what was destined to happen will happen. Try as much as you want to prevent it. What is not destined to happen will never happen. Try as much as you want to make it happen. Well, when he says that in the current situation, I mean, not the current situation, generally we see, you know, a lot of astrologers who are very famous quoting that we have solutions to whatever problems you have, be it marriage, be it your job, be it your finances, whatever issues you have, we have solutions to it. And when you approach them, they say, do this puja, do this donation, do this homam, I mean, yeah, whatever pujas, and that will fix the issues. But if that is true, that in a way contradicts what Ramana Maharshi says, right? Because Ramana Maharshi says, whatever you do, you cannot change destiny and things will happen the way they ought to happen. So somewhere, if you can provide more clarity on this, Gautam, because of late, we see so many astrologers springing up, a lot of people visiting the astrologers with the hope that, you know, they will be able to find solutions for the problems which they're currently facing. So if you can please throw more light, that would be great, Gautam.
Sure. Aki, there are various aspects to this. So I would like to touch upon them one by one. One is the science of astrology is an ancient science. Okay. Yeah. And it is so important. It was so important in our land. You see, because the Vedic astrologers, their advice was taken when the child was not only born, but when the child was going to school. They had become advisors to the Gurukuls. And they would guide the gurus as to the temperaments of each child. What are they best suited for in terms of study? In relation to their horoscope, what are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? So it's a most beautiful science, the science of astrology, which goes back for eons, right? And why is it popular today also is because of good astrologer. And a good astrologer is one who brings his insights as well as intuition to a horoscope, can throw light on somebody's life journey. Now, that is one aspect. Okay. The other aspect is, will doing a ritual solve a problem? Will doing a havan solve a problem? If the astrologer says, do this and do that, your problems will go away. You see, now this is where things get difficult. Firstly, the science of havans is also a very ancient science, fire rituals, for those who don't know the word havan, offerings to the fire, because the fire represents life. The sun is fire. Sun is the life force, right? So, these are again rituals laid down by the ancients. They have meaning. They bring certain vibrations to the atmosphere, to the environment, no doubt. The whole problem comes in when rituals are prescribed as a solution to a problem. Because it is almost everyone's experience that they have in India, amongst us Hindus, done various pujas, but we have not got the desired results. I know enough people who have been prescribed homams, pujas and all that. But the whole point is, you see, this is all fear-based. We want to change an outcome, so we indulge in all this thing. What has happened is a beautiful science. You know, whether it is astrology, whether it is tarot card reading also was started purely to project the subconscious mind onto the cards so the person could get a better understanding of his own makeup, his fears, issues, and so on. These are beautiful tools which came for a reason. But today, everyone's concern is money, health, or relationships. You ask any astrologer, their business comes from advice on money, health, relationships. That is the nature of us humans, you see. So as Ramana Maharshi said, that it all depends on one's prarabdha. That is why you will find people who are working very hard in front of your own eyes are not making as much money as someone who's not working hard, but making a lot of money. What accounts for that? It is one's direct experience that one's effort in this life is not producing those results that they should. And then you meet a friend or a colleague and, you know, he's saying, oh, I have my father's wealth and it earns me X amount of money per month. I'm enjoying my life. What accounts for that? Will pujas help them? You see, now jnanis have said that you think someone has won a lottery ticket. But in their astral body, at that particular time, in that particular year, in that particular month, that was already there in their subtle body to sprout forth and bring sudden fortune based on the prarabdha. So this direct you know, I do this and this will happen. It doesn't work that way. What astrologers can do is hold one's hand to help ease situations. What has to be faced has to be faced. Now, I'm saying here because through my journey, I have met many astrologers, psychics, and not as consultations. They have come my way. They are friends. I have many of them who are close friends, people who are clairaudient, clairvoyant, and so on. But this is the common thing, that it is not about changing anyone's destiny. It is whatever gift they have been given, they bring it forth for the person in front of them. So none of them, at least I would say none of the authentic ones, would say that do this and your problem will be solved. You know, so I think Ramana Maharshi summed it up just perfectly. Because imagine you didn't have this knowledge. Imagine you couldn't go to an astrologer. Imagine you could not do a homam or havan or whatever. That means only those who are privileged to have this access and can do all this can change their destinies. Does that make sense? That is not fair. I mean, not fair, but that's not going to happen.
Correct.
The human being is the human being. You see? So, many events in our lives, if you take the biggest events in your lives, let's say, I don't know, maybe you lost someone or you lost money or whatever. Choose the biggest event in your life and know that that happened because it was meant to happen. And you see, it is the teaching which starts pervading one's thinking. That is what starts happening. So in this time, now there are so many opinions from astrologers, videos which have come. In India, this problem will be solved by April. Then someone said June. Then someone said September. Who is right? Who is wrong? So many opinions. Whom to follow? And what this teaching says is, be concerned with your peace of mind. What is destined to happen will happen, and what is not destined will not. Do what you think and feel you should do and leave the results to God. Take all the precautions you think you should take. Use the intellect that you have been gifted with, knowing that the outcome is not in your control. It can't get more simpler than that, you see.
Yeah.
So there is another aspect of astrology which I just got a deeper insight into. Sometimes people feel what the horoscope shows does not match what has happened in their life. And it was an eye-opener for me that an astrologer said that is likely the case because that is not the correct time of birth which was recorded. And he gave me a case study of someone's horoscope. And if he rectified the time, then all the main events in the rectified time appear in the horoscope. That means the time of birth on the birth certificate was incorrectly put. And this has happened, you know, if people are over the age of 70, 75, so you're going back 75 years, it was likely that there was a gap of a few couple of minutes in the recording of the exact time of birth. Now, even that, look at the science. The science can also move a bit back and forth and say, no, the recorded time of birth is not matching with the events in your life. Now, Maharaj would say that taking the time of birth is incorrect. You should take the time of conception. You see? So where does this end? And I have very often given this story, so I'm going to tell it to you, but I hope the others don't mind because I repeat it often, about Paul Brunton, who wrote the book A Search in Secret India, and he studied in Varanasi astrology with India's leading astrologer. And at the end of the course, he said, Maharaj, I have one question to ask of you. Do you read your own horoscope? And the astrologer replied that when I accepted that whatever happens in my life is God's will, I stopped reading my horoscope.
So Gautam, Ramana Maharshi says that, you know, your prarabdha karma is set once the soul enters the mother's womb itself, and your entire life events are already predetermined and predestined while you're in your mother's womb itself. And it's like a movie which is now being watched. You can only see it happening. You can only witness it happening. But as the director cannot change the movie while viewing it on the screen, similarly, you cannot change anything of your life events. You can only witness them, or you can only experience them. That is one point, if you could elaborate on that. And the other one is, say, for example, if there is a soldier who went on wars and killed the people of other countries, hypothetically taking a situation where the soldier now gets onto the spiritual mode and gets into enlightenment, gets awareness, will he be able to go and fight and kill people after getting enlightenment?
So the answer to the first point is, there is one thing that can change, and that is your attitude to life. That is why when Dayanand Saraswati was asked about free will, he said, you have as much free will as a goat which is tied by a rope to a peg. And so the movement of the goat is restricted to the length, the maximum length the rope will go, because within that, the goat is allowed to move. Does the goat have free will? To the extent of the length of the rope, it has free will. It cannot graze beyond that length. But within that length, it can graze where it wants. So what he was referring to is that while we are gifted with a set of circumstances in life, situations in life, what we can really look at is our attitude to these situations. Whatever is going to come your way is going to come. Maharaj used to say, the expected seldom happens and the unexpected always does. That is one's life experience. How one's attitude is to what happens changes a lot of things, not in terms of what one is meant to experience, but here. That is the gift of these teachings. And regarding the soldier, I don't know if you've seen that video where a European soldier, ex-former soldier from a war, came to my teacher, Ramishji. And he actually came to express his gratitude, because he said all his life he carried this guilt because he had killed enemy soldiers. And then he read a book of Ramishji's where Ramishji said that you were trained to be a soldier. Even his grandfather was a soldier, this man said. So the entire conditioning and programming was that of a soldier. He was conscripted into the army. So he did what he was designed to do, just like Arjuna, right? He was designed to be a warrior. He had the genetics of a warrior. And it was the same thing, because when Krishna told Arjuna that pick up that bow and fight, you are putting it down. But all your life you've been designed to be a warrior. And as time, I, Krishna, have already killed them. But you are taking it as if you are doing it. And this soldier, he told Rameshji, he said, you know, all this guilt I had been carrying, when I read in your book that my conditioning was of being a soldier. It was even in the genetic map of the family. They were conditioned and programmed genetically to be warriors, and they carried out a task which was destined for them. And he said, all that burden I had been carrying fell away. And he said, that's why I have come to you to Bombay. And he fell at his feet and burst out crying. And of course, he was very old. When we saw him, he must have been in his 70s. The war must have been decades ago. So this is the beauty of the teaching, you see. So if he was young, the soldier would still continue being the soldier, just like it is said in the Bhagavad Gita. Dharma is dharma. Okay. Yes, Jerome.
Yeah, yes, hello. I don't so much have a question, but I would like to check my understanding, because I've been contemplating further since last week. And I've come to the conclusion that it's not witnessing so much, but it is surrender, which is the core of the philosophy. And it struck me that this surrender is just like an attitude, really. It is an attitude we take. And it is, whether you believe in God or not, perhaps it's not that important, because we know there's ego, that is for sure. So if you take the attitude, this attitude is directly opposite of ego. In fact, you're denying ego. And it struck me, and with it came a kind of feeling of bliss, and a very subtle bliss feeling. So I guess it must be correct. So I think it's more than peace of mind. It's also bliss which comes in its wake. So the Chinese also say that tai du shi yiqie, everything is attitude. So yeah, that is.
No, so you have put it well. It is the surrender, Jerome, which leads to witnessing more and more in daily living.
Exactly, yes.
Yes. It is. So you see, that's why I keep saying witnessing is not a doing. You can't do witnessing. Witnessing happens. So,
yeah.
You know, let's take a very simple example. There's someone in front of you who you don't like as such, not as much as you like others. Let's say one friend who kind of you just don't vibrate with or gel with that much, right?
Yeah.
Now, if there is surrender to what is, a total acceptance that this person is the way, let's not use even God, like you said, the way he has been made. I don't know what his conditioning is, what his childhood was. He just says things and does things. Perhaps, you know, like a robot, based on his genetics and conditioning. This understanding itself means what? That one is surrendered to what is, to who he is as a person in front of you. And you are no longer in a frame of mind where you think he is deliberately doing that. And this surrender leads to witnessing.
Yes. So
surrender leads to witnessing.
Exactly. That is, and also, much earlier, I already came to the conclusion that it is the distance between consciousness and thought, which actually is the space in which all virtue arises. But how to take this distance? So I thought, I tried self-inquiry, but actually it is not that easy. But I find this surrender is much easier. It's I don't know. It seems. I felt, you know, like you taught me how to tie my shoelaces. That is how I felt. It's, hey. It's so simple, actually. But I guess, yeah. Yeah, that's what.
Yes, you see, because this can become very conceptual, this gap between, let's say the gap between two thoughts arising is where peace resides or consciousness resides. Use whatever word you want. The difficulty with this is that it can become an endless practice, you see. Now, let's take something similar. Siddharameshwar Maharaj says that if you look at a lamp in your bedroom, or if you look at, if you can see a tree outside your window or building outside your window, your eye goes to the object, but you keep your vision between the object and your eye, which is the consciousness in between, you see? Now, this is what he's pointing at. What he's pointing at is that one will start seeing that it is within one's own consciousness, of course, that all objects in manifestation arise, come and go. You know, they just are fleeting. But that field of consciousness is stable. And so, when one is surrendered, one is already in that field. And in that field, therefore, witnessing arises one of what is happening. You see, the difference is, now what is happening to me as an individual, that dialogue starts going down and gets replaced by what is happening. There's a very important distinction here. The me, the contracted me, me and my story, and I'm the center of the universe, which was so strong, with surrender, when that grip opens up, the what is happening to me becomes what is happening. And that is the surrender.
Yeah.
Now, let us look at something objectively. Again, this has come up because I made a short podcast on this. Money. Okay. Many people have lost money in the lockdown. In India, we had 2 years of bad economic situation before the lockdown. In the stock market, people have lost money, so on and so forth, you know. Now, I will tell you my own experience, because there's nothing like one's own experience. I had put some money in the stock market, much against my nature, because I don't understand numbers, frankly. I'm not a numbers guy. And I'm someone who was happy with a bank fixed deposit. That is my nature, because, you know, the mind to be consumed. Like some people, it's natural to be stockbrokers, look at the market going up and down and all. Now, I have a panel on my laptop which shows me the amount invested and the current value, which, as you can imagine, is substantially lower than the amount invested. But then it struck me that what I'm looking at are just numbers. These numbers don't have any story to tell. When there's a me who feels I have lost money, then I project meaning onto the numbers. But when I'm surrendered to what is, which is an investment which had a certain value, is now at another value, in this case lower, and if my vision stays at that, then one objectively looks at the situation, sees, okay, do I exit, do I stay? And it's a very clear level of thinking. But the drama, when the me comes in and says, oh my God, my investment is up. How did this happen? Was I so stupid? Didn't I see this coming? I can't believe this has happened to me. Whose advice did I take? Why did I take their advice? All that dialogue is finished. And the numbers on the screen stay as numbers. It is you who are telling yourself a story about the numbers. And this is with everything in your life. Look at everything and see how you're pulling it back into the me and my story. And then what will happen is, instead of this happened to me, it changes to this happened. That will be your life's experience more and more. And this surrendered state of being becomes more and more permanent, because you are surrendered to what is, not what should be and not what was. And therefore, witnessing starts happening more and more and more and more.
Yes.
Okay, that was beautiful. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Harish.
Oh, hi, it's me, Roshni.
Hi, Roshni, the usual suspects.
Well, I don't know. I have sent you an email. I don't know if you've received it or read it. I have no idea. But my basic problem is, since you have always been emphasizing so much on God's will and this thing about accepting, surrendering, it's been a big, huge battle within me. And as you have been saying that since the lockdown, you have, there's nothing but to face yourself much more than before, because initially you would just run away, get out of the house and engage yourself in whatever, you know. And basically it was running away from yourself, and now it is just, everything is stark reality right in front of me. And it's a huge struggle, and to accept. And then there is attachment when the lockdown is opening and your loved ones are stepping out. So I think I had also emailed you about, if you're talking about, I'm not trying to defy or deny you, but I'm just trying to understand, is that God's will, then so many people suffering. And I was aghast at the elephant incident that happened, the poor innocent animal. I mean, knowing God, he wouldn't want, or he wouldn't resort to such things. So how can he be just sitting quietly and looking at all these things happening? I don't know what you're going to term it as, that ego or whatever, but it's, all this is just going on in my mind. So yeah, I've come to again find answers. And I would also request you to please send me some kind of, through your emails, send some kind of notifications or something to anchor myself, because I'm sure you know by now my mind. It's very evident. You don't have to know more about as what I'm sounding.
Roshni, you also know your mind because you know all these things. So who knows it? You see?
Yeah, but it's such a battle.
See, you know, we've said this many times before, that we put on a moral definition onto God because we picture God as an individual. Now, the philosophy of Advaita, which means not what appears to be with the two eyes, not to, Advaita, not to, non-dual, means that, as we have seen historically, you have had Hitler, you have had Osama bin Laden, you have some terrible things which have happened in the history of the world. Now, when we say that is God's will in Advaita, what does it mean? It means, don't think of God as a person. God is the totality of what is, the totality of polaric opposites God is that force which made a Mother Teresa as well as a Hitler. For example, the good and the bad, the polaric opposites. And we have found historically also how the good has come together to fight the evil and so on. But why is everything God's will? Because if Hitler was not God's will, that means there is something more powerful than God to have created Hitler. You see, then it becomes an unending cycle in duality. So this is the end of duality. That the source from which everything comes, the one source from which the entire manifestation has sprung from, is non-dual. Because if we are in duality, then we are saying that there's another power which is stronger than God, which made all the evil in the world. That means God is not all-powerful. Is that true? So this dualistic thinking is what we grew up with, we are conditioned with. And when someone is drawn to this teaching, what happens is the acceptance that, yes, I have now understood the design of life based on my own living. I've had happy moments, I've had sad moments. I've had ups, I've had downs. I can turn left, I can turn right. I'm designed in duality. This is the structure of life. There is going to be pain, there is going to be pleasure. I have to accept that, because when I don't accept that, then I am the one suffering. To not accept what is to suffer. Now, after accepting what is, do exactly what you think and feel you should do. That's all you can do. It doesn't mean don't do anything. Just sit back as a couch potato and accept what is. But accept that, as Ramana Maharshi said, as Aki said, what is destined to happen will happen. And what is not meant to won't. Because not accepting that is keeping the ego, the thinking mind of the ego, alive. No, I don't accept that. Me, I do not accept this. It does not make sense to me. Who is this person talking? So if you do find that you are not able to accept that this is God's will, allow that to be. Don't struggle with it, that, oh no, I must accept it is God's will. Someone else must convince me. Stay with it. With the understanding that in this body-mind organism called Roshni, this acceptance that God could have harmed that elephant is not happening. I don't accept that that is God's will, because God cannot do harm. So be it. The mind of Roshni has not accepted it. Be comfortable with that. But deep down, Roshni, you would not be here if at some level that acceptance had not happened. The resistance is from the mind.
So are you trying to say that the mind is that stubborn and that, resisting the what I want to? Basically, I'm here for peace. So the resistance is causing this not at peace with myself, because I'm not surrendering. And so you're trying to say that the mind is that powerful?
Oh, yes. The mind is very powerful. The thinking mind, rather. The thinking mind is alive. The thinking mind of the ego is the monkey mind, which wants to be recognized all the time. Look at me, I am in pain. Now you know who I am. That is the thinking mind. Oh, I can't bear that this is happening in the world. Who can't bear it? The thinking mind, because now it derives its sense of self from events. I don't like these events that are happening. Look at me. You see, that is all the mind, the identification of the mind with things that are happening, and then it forms opinions and judgments about them. You know, in the Kargil war, this is when my guru was alive. He said he was watching TV and he saw all those bodies of the army, the soldiers killed, being brought in the caskets to the airport. And tears arose in his eyes. And what did he do? He said, I sat back. I thought of the families who had lost their loved ones to protect our country. And I did what was in my power to do, which is I pulled out my checkbook, wrote a check to the Prime Minister's relief fund or whatever, and posted it the next day. So accepting what is, it doesn't mean that he was fine, it's all non-dual, everything is God's will. The feeling arose of sorrow when he saw that on the TV. And thereafter, he did what he thought he could do best, which is he had some money and he sent it. That is how the sage lives, you see. But we then create this whole drama and story about it, and we get caught up in it because we derive our identity from that. The mind does that. What I would suggest is that from here on, just look at the antics of the mind. Just be aware that the mind is thinking this, the mind is thinking that. That itself will become a spiritual learning for you. Not with this is right and this is wrong, and this is wrong and this is right. Just look at how it operates. Okay?
Thank you.
We'll take one more question. Yes, Ami.
Hello, Gautam. How are you?
I'm good.
I have two questions, just following on what everybody else was saying.
Did you put your hand up for the riddle answer?
Yes, it was me, but I got no prize, so nothing for my answer. So I did have the right answer.
Okay.
So now I get to ask two questions. my first question is, I'm just following on what Madame Rashini was saying. It's regarding when God's will. I also have this problem with God's will, when you have to personally within yourself to have an opinion or judge somebody, like murderers, rapists, pedophiles, or whatever. So you understand these are also part of God's will. But then how do you form your own opinion about them? Because they have to be treated certain way within the society. So if it's God's will, what's the difference between them and me, for example?
In one sense, there's no difference, Ami, because we are all instruments which are given a set of attributes and conditioning, right? Different people have been conditioned differently. Some have got the conditioning of being thieves, for example, and let's say murdering, right? Now, thankfully, since we are all living in societies, we have laws in place, because when this happens,
yes,
it has to be corrected. So obviously, I would have an opinion in that sense that what has happened is not right because you've taken someone else's life. Correct?
Yes.
Laws are in place to deal with that situation.
But even to have the laws, even to have those opinions, you have to have some sort of judgment about those people. It doesn't come out of nothing. You know, it comes out of the belief that those actions are condemned.
Of course they are, because if you look at it, let's look at it a bit laterally, if you don't mind. If you truly had the understanding that the same consciousness flows through everyone, okay?
Yes.
That nobody truly does anything, the same consciousness flows through everyone. Can consciousness hate consciousness? Can you hate another? You can't hate another with this understanding. And therefore, forget hate. Where is the question of murdering another, for example, right?
Yes. So
what happens is that certain people, and depending on the circumstances they have been born into, what life has made them commit certain acts, you see? And they are going to be held accountable because our moral compass, so to speak, is in place that this is just not correct. So that is going to kick in, because after all, even we have been given our senses and minds to think what is right and what is wrong. Even that is God's will, correct? But
yes.
The difference is, like I give this example often, that my mother's guru, Justice Budhar, he was a judge. And he had to sentence criminals to very harsh imprisonment. And what he would do is, after reading out the sentence, he would get off his chair, and some of them, for where he felt compassion, he would give them a hug. You know, depending on the case, if someone said, you know, I don't know, I lost my mind, this happened, that happened, I don't know those details. But the judge had this understanding that laws are in place to deal with this situation. Mm-hmm. What has happened is horrific. But at the same time, sometimes he could perhaps sense that the person was helpless or what, I don't know. That did not stop him from going across and embracing the person, you see. That is the beauty of the sage. What we do is we start finger pointing and blaming and condemning and hating.
Yes.
Whereas the sage sees things for what it is. This has happened. The murder has happened through this body-mind organism. And if it is destined to go to court, be tried and held accountable, that will happen. The sage does not get involved in this whole drama which we get involved in.
Yes. I mean, to get back to a current event right now in North America, we have a lot of protests happening for Black Lives Matters.
Yes.
And some people believe that they have to go protest in solidarity with the rest of people. And some people think that you should have non-racism within yourself.
Yes.
So it's how to judge which one is the right way. Work with about yourself or make a stand for somebody else's right.
Yes, absolutely beautiful. Because what happens with this understanding is you will stand for what you believe is right, correct?
Yes.
Now you know that the others who are standing for what they believe is right, they are entitled to. You see, your fight is no longer personal. You know you have been given a set of conditioning and genetics and attributes on the basis of which you know for you what is right and what is wrong. Now, someone who has the opposite view, now the understanding is that is the way they are seeing the situation. So your position is no longer of conflict and opposition, which is what has been our conditioning. You see, that is how it operates. And let me just boil down to this very simple example I have given many times in talks about me sitting at the club one day with two friends and a girl sitting 20 feet away. And one friend says, oh, what a beautiful yellow dress she is wearing. And the other friend says, oh, it's a beautiful dress, but it's not yellow and it's green. And they got into argument, yellow, green, yellow, green. And I'm just watching this like a tennis match. I said, look here, you both have agreed it's a beautiful dress. For you, it's yellow and for you, it's green. What does it matter? So this fighting, this conflict, this opposition that I am right and you are wrong is seen in an objective light. Now, Ami, look, things, what they appear to be today, there is so much behind them, you know.
Yeah.
There is so much history behind this. I mean, let us take the way this all started with the blacks coming to America. Isn't that itself so unfortunate that they came as slaves and the way they were treated? And the collective conditioning has now reacted that how long can this go on? So there's a reason for everything. We cannot make sense of it. But now with this understanding, we know that in order for this uprising to happen, an instrument called George Floyd's life was taken. So everything is interconnected. We cannot see the interconnectedness. And then we start passing judgments. if you look at what masters have said on karmic theories, all these killings have gone on for centuries. There's a cause effect. The same thing is being perpetuated because of a lack of understanding and a lack of compassion. It is very unfortunate. How much of it has changed? See, over the years, right from the Crusades, we've been going to war.
So in time like this, is it better to be part of the movement or just silently work on yourself?
No, on your own? You must do precisely that which you think and feel you should do. You must honor that, which only you will know. This teaching is not going to tell you to be silent and not do anything. If you are feeling passionate about something, that must be honored because you have been designed that way, right?
Yes.
So you must honor that. This is not about being passive. But what happens is there is a sense of now distance or detachment because you're no longer wound up in this reactionary mode. Now the understanding is there. You're seeing the situation objectively. So your reaction, which was earlier based on perhaps something that happened to you and wound you up in your childhood and all that, you know how it is. We all are projecting our own conditioning onto situations. Now, with the light of understanding, there's a light of clarity. Individuals are no longer being targeted, but what is in this specific case being targeted is a collective sense of what's going on. So your approach will change. It doesn't mean you will sit back silently if it's not your nature to sit back. But the light of understanding now shines through your eyes. You know, I don't know why I'm reminded of this, because maybe I talked about the blacks coming as slaves. There is so little that we know. The Red Indians, I believe, were a very enlightened tribe. And their land was taken away from them. Now, I remember...
It was done to the other Indians as well.
Yeah, now, you know, I remember one thing, Ami, that, you see, the Red Indian chief used to wear this headgear of feathers. Yes. Big feathers, right? And he was the chief of the tribe. And people would make fun. At least in India, I remember as a child, oh, look at this, Red Indian chief. Of course, we were children and there was innocence in that. He's wearing such long feathers on his head. Do you know that my mother had this experience? She started seeing many visions and she saw that an enlightened master whose crown is wide open, let's say in touch with the universal consciousness, it throws out rays of light, okay, like this. She saw that vision. And what immediately came into her mind was the Red Indian chief's headgear, which represents reaching up to the heavens, tapping into the universal consciousness. And for us, what is it? Someone wearing feathers on his head, you see. Similarly, in ancient times, all kings were enlightened beings. Why do you think kings were made to wear crowns? The crowns represented crown chakras. A fully open and enlightened being operates from here. And that is what the crown signified. And then there was a descent into all this mundane material chaos where, you know, emperors would conquer lands, they would steal gems and put it into the crown saying, oh, now I've conquered this. And see, that's how things descended. But the ancient kings were truly enlightened beings. That is why they were made kings, because they had insights into situations and they were in touch with totality. They were objective, they were neutral. And now we have gone into this whole era of politics, chaos, confusion, and that is God's will.
Thank you. I also have my second question. Can I ask, or is it too late already?
You can take it as the last one, because, you know, I have to add here, we have Sangeeta, who lives in Ecuador and stays up late. She helps coordinate the Zoom. So everyone, please thank her in your minds. And Divya in Bombay helps with this. So Bombay is okay, I think, Divya, in terms of time. But for Sangeeta, it becomes a very late night. So
it's pretty early morning, 2:30 in the morning. So
Okay.
So my next question would be, I will ask it very fast. So when we're talking about awareness and surrender and consciousness, so if I am aware, present, and consciousness, what's the difference between the awareness I would have or so Ramana Maharishi would have? Isn't the awareness the awareness? While that awareness is that has such an effect on massive people, while the awareness, like somebody like me would say, it's not even helping myself.
Awareness is awareness. There's no doubt about it. But the difference is that one awareness is rooted in the self, and one awareness is rooted in duality. What I mean is, let's say we take two people right now, you and someone else watching this session, and I press a button and your memory is completely wiped out. You will still be aware. You will know that you exist, but you don't know that you exist as Anna.
Yes.
Similarly, if I take someone else, they will still know they exist. But they don't know that they exist as so-and-so. So that is awareness, abide in one's being. Okay. The difference is that in the sage, he is rooted in that 24 hours a day, not even in the waking state. The jnani is rooted in that even in deep sleep. He is even aware in deep sleep. So he is a master. His awareness is never not there. Whereas for us simple beings, with this teaching, what happens is when our thinking mind is now, the curtains are parted, we live our life in awareness, which is so beautiful because it was like the earlier life was a dream. I was so mired and embroiled and involved in it, I had no peace of mind. But now by God's grace, at least I am gifted peace of mind in daily living. So that is a most beautiful awareness which is accessible to everyone. That is the simplicity of this teaching.
How to abide in it 24/7?
It will happen if it's meant to happen.
Thank you very much.
That is why I tell everyone, thank God for your deep sleep. Do you at least thank God for that? Thank God for at least 1/3 of your 24 hours. You are given the gift of deep sleep. When your thinking mind is not working, there are some people who don't get sleep at night. I have to take pills for that because of the anxiety of the mind. But just one day, wake up and say, God, how kind of you, how compassionate of you that you have given me a break from my mental projections and image making and perceived problems and troubles and judgments. At least you have given me this gift, this most underrated gift of deep sleep.